The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Good morning. Welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, but today, through the magic of Zoom, we are in your living room. My name is Ann Rostosky, and I'm today's worship leader. I'm a member of the board here at Thomas Paine. And we have a guest speaker, Butch Larsenies, who is also a member today. So wherever, whoever you are, wherever you come from, whoever you love, wherever you are in your hero's journey, please walk with us for the next hour. And now, Rosalind Wealth and Phil Manos will light our chalice, after which Preston Lutweiler will light our peace lamp.
This is Mental Illness Awareness Month. I light the chalice in honor of my mother and others who spent years, many years, locked up with no treatment before treatment was available. And that is not a myth.
After I light the peace lamp, your response will be, and with all the people of the world. May peace be with us, and with all the people of the world.
All the people of the world.
And now we will sing our gathering song. The song is We Are, and it was written by Dr. Issei Barnwell, and the performance that we're going to see was from the UUA General Assembly last year. So the words are on the slide, so please sing along.
For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. Oh, for each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. Oh, for each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. We are our grandmother's prayers, and we are our grandfather's dreamings, and we are the breath of our ancestors. We are the spirit of God. We are mothers of courage, fathers of time, daughters of dust, and the sons of great visions. We're sisters of mercy, brothers of love, lovers of life, and the builders of nations. We're seekers of truth, keepers of faith, makers of peace, and the wisdom of ages. We are our grandmother's prayers. We are our grandfather's dreamings, and we are the breath of our ancestors. We are the spirit of God. We are mothers of courage, fathers of time, daughters of dust, and the sons of great visions. We're sisters of mercy, brothers of love, lovers of life, and the builders of nations. We're seekers of truth and keepers of faith. We are makers of peace, and the wisdom of ages, we are our grandmother's prayers, we are our grandfather's dreamings, and we are the breath of our ancestors, we are the spirit of God, we are our grandmother's prayers, and we are our grandfather's dreamings. We are the breath of our ancestors. We are the spirit of God. For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are one.
You're now going to have a moment for all ages. It's a video clip on the hero's journey according to Joseph Campbell. The video is by Matthew Winkler and Kirill Yurevsky.
What do Harry Potter, Katniss Everdeen, and Frodo all have in common with the heroes of ancient myths? What if I told you they are all variants of the same hero? Do you believe that? Joseph Campbell did. He studied myths from all over the world and published a book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces, retelling dozens of stories and explaining how each represents the monomyth or hero's journey. So, what is the hero's journey? Think of it as a cycle. The journey begins and ends in the hero's ordinary world, but the quest passes through an unfamiliar, special world. Along the way, there are some key events. Think about your favorite book or movie. Does it follow this pattern? Status quo, that's where we start. 1 o'clock, call to adventure. The hero receives a mysterious message, an invitation, a challenge. 2 o'clock, assistance. The hero needs some help, probably from someone older, wiser. 3 o'clock, departure. The hero crosses the threshold from his normal, safe home and enters the special world and adventure. We're not in Kansas anymore. 4 o'clock, trials. Being a hero is hard work. Our hero solves a riddle, slays a monster, escapes from a trap. 5 o'clock, approach. It's time to face the biggest ordeal, the hero's worst fear. 6 o'clock, crisis. This is the hero's darkest hour. He faces death and possibly even dies, only to be reborn. 7 o'clock, treasure. As a result, the hero claims some treasure, special recognition, or power. 8 o'clock, result. This can vary between stories. Do the monsters bow down before the hero, or do they chase him as he flees from the special world? 9 o'clock, return. After all that adventure, the hero returns to his ordinary world. 10 o'clock, new life. This quest has changed the hero. He has outgrown his old life. 11 o'clock, resolution. All the tangled plot lines get straightened out. 12 o'clock, status quo, but upgraded to a new level. Nothing is quite the same once you're a hero. Many popular books and movies follow this ancient formula pretty closely, but let's see how well The Hunger Games fits the hero's journey template. When does Katniss Everdeen hear a call to adventure that gets the story moving? When her sister's name is called from the lottery? How about assistance? Is anyone going to help her on her adventure? Haymitch. What about departure? Does she leave her ordinary world? She gets on a train to the capital. Okay, so you get the idea. What do you have in common with Harry Potter, Katniss Everdeen, and Frodo?
Okay, so now you know how the hero's journey works. We're going to have a musical meditation, and this particular song is from The Last of the Mohicans movie, which is a beloved movie to me, and it follows Nathaniel. He is the protagonist. He's thrust into a hero's journey by the circumstances he's in, and this song was written by Trevor Jones, and it's going to be performed by an indigenous person from Colombia by the name of Giovanni Laguardo. So I hope you enjoy this. And now for our sermon. Our speaker today is Butch Larsenese. Butch is a member of Thomas Paine Fellowship, and he also was active with our Mystics group when we were meeting in person. He's written a book about crystal grids and has given us talks before about Buddhism and crystals. And today he will be speaking about some his own personal hero's journey and some others that he's familiar with. So now I will turn it over to Butch.
Thank you, Ann. Good morning. I'll bet you don't think that you're living a mythical life or that myths can help you. Recently, I have been increasingly aware of how mythology has been in my life and in the lives of my mother and father. Myth lets you know that it's happened to other people before, and you're not alone. then maybe the myth can help you by providing an answer. Joseph Campbell said that the hero's journey requires a death and a resurrection. That's the basic motif of the universal hero's journey, leaving one condition and finding the source of life to bring you forth into a richer or more mature condition. The following are three hero's journeys. Well, this is the myth that seemed appropriate for my father. This is pretty much the way I understand him in myth. This is my dad's myth. My father sought security in his life. For him, his security was work. He was a self-employed electrician, so he always worried about getting the next job. This then morphed into, let's finish this job quickly so that we can get on to the next job before the customer changes their mind. Or if there wasn't a next job, let's finish this job quickly so that we can be prepared for the next job when it comes. When my father retired, he bumped into one of his doctors. The doctor told my father that he looked different, more relaxed. He asked what changed in my father's life to make him more relaxed. My father answered that nothing changed and that he was always relaxed. The doctor wouldn't let up. I'm going to ask your son. I bet your son knows. What changed in your father's life? I answered, he retired. That's it, he said. He could notice with the distance of time that I could not see my father every day. My father was the Grail King, and the Grail King is sick. He is always carried in a litter because he is so weak. And when the king is sick, his sickness is visited upon the land. The crops won't grow, and the sheep and cattle are starving. The king rules over a wasteland. And what is a wasteland? It is a land where everybody is living an inauthentic life. My father was living only the life of survival. He didn't progress from there. One day, my father and I were wiring the finished basement of a carpenter's house, and upstairs came a cry of pain. I ran up to the steps into the kitchen where the carpenter was using his circular saw to cut some wood. I asked him, Emery, what happened? He told me he sliced off some skin from the tip of his finger with the saw. Emery didn't want to go to the hospital. Instinctively, I went to the refrigerator where it had a water dispenser that could also dispense ice. I figured that the ice cold water would not only slow down the bleeding, but would also numb some of the pain. As I dipped his finger in a cup, it wouldn't be long until the blood filled the cup along with the water, and I would have to dump the contents in the sink and fill the cup again with cold water and ice. At one point, I interrupted this process and went downstairs to the basement to inform my father as to why I wasn't in the basement helping him with wiring. I told Dad what had happened. He said nothing and continued along with wiring. I went back upstairs to the kitchen to help Emery, back to the cups of water and ice. This process went on for about a half an hour until Emery felt better and was no longer bleeding. I wondered to myself, what kind of person was my father, not to run to help someone in the cries of pain or to ask about the welfare of another human being, only to continue on with his work unaffected. The only way the Grail King and his wasteland kingdom can be saved is by Percival the Grail Knight. Percival is the innocent hero, and as a hero, he is the part of you that represents a new way of living. What heroic deed will Percival have to do? He must ask a question. Particular question. For years during his quest, Percival doesn't know what to do to heal the Grail King's land. He doesn't know, he has to ask a question. One day he gets an opportunity to visit the Grail King inside his castle. He sees the Grail King, sick, kept alive simply by the presence of the Grail. At his first visit to the castle, Percival doesn't ask the king a question, so the castle and the king disappear. After a five-year quest to return, Percival gets back into the castle. Out of compassion, Percival asks the king, "What ails you, uncle?" Suddenly, the king arises from his litter healed, the crops grow, and the sheep and cattle are healthy and well-fed. The kingdom is no longer a wasteland. The question is an expression, not of the principles of survival, but of compassion, the natural opening of the human heart to another human being. That's the Grail. Fortunately, unlike Percival, my father didn't have to wait 5 years to get back into the castle. About a year later, my father redeemed himself by asking the Grail question when my mother got severely ill. Now here's a myth that kind of encapsulates my mom. I don't know what happened to mom either in the external world or just inside her head before I was born to cause her to develop an image of herself as ugly. She thought everyone was looking at her and judging her appearance. So she became agoraphobic and never left the house. Her brother said that in 1944, when my mother was 23, the whole family noticed a change in her. They didn't know what it was. They said amongst themselves, "Something is wrong with Angie." I can't begin to tell you the toll this had on my mother and father's marriage. She never wanted to go on vacation or out to visit friends or relatives or to go out to see a movie. Susanoo was brother of the sun goddess Amaterasu. Susanoo neglected his duties in the realm of the sea and caused every sort of disturbance on the land, which the sun goddess Amaterasu had previously ruled with benevolence and wisdom. Susanoo ignored his sister's pleas and destroyed rice fields, uprooted trees, and even leveled sacred buildings. As a final provocation, he broke a hole in the roof of the hall where his sister, the sun goddess Amaterasu, was sitting and watching other deities weaving heavenly garments, and her brother Susanoo threw in the body of a dead horse. Susanoo was a mischief maker, playing wicked pranks and constantly upsetting his elder sister. The goddesses who were weaving were so shocked that many were injured and some died. The sun goddess Amaterasu withdrew, either out of embarrassment or out of fear, into a cave that led deep within the center of the earth and refused to come out, causing darkness and cold in the world. The other 800 gods begged the sun goddess Amaterasu to come out of her cave, but to no avail. And they collected roosters and hung an eight-handed mirror and jewels on a tree in front of the cave where the sun goddess Amaterasu was hiding. One of the goddesses began a dance on an upturned tub, partially disrobing herself, which so delighted the assembled gods that they roared with laughter. They laughed so loud that the sun goddess Amaterasu heard their laughter and became curious. As the sun goddess Amaterasu opened the door of the cave slowly and quietly to peek outside, the rooster saw her light and began to crow. The jewels on the tree glittered, and the mirror hanging on a tree reflected her light. She saw her own reflection and thought to herself that there must be someone or something equal to herself illuminating the world. As she opened the door a little wider, the deity, who was waiting behind the door, pulled the sun goddess Amaterasu out of the cave and quickly threw a sacred rope of rice straw before the entrance. Pointing to the sacred rope, the deity told the sun goddess Amaterasu, "You may approach this far, but no further." Amaterasu agreed to remain in the visible world and never again to withdraw. In 1992, my mother was rapidly losing her memory. She didn't know how to use a calendar, a fork, a spoon, a knife to turn on and off a light switch or a faucet handle. But she did remember people in the past. We visited her family doctor, a neurologist, a psychologist, and then finally a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist diagnosed mom with severe depression and put her on the right medicine that turned her life around. Her memory didn't come back. She had to relearn everything. She also had a small diminishment in her thinking, but was a very happy person. The old habit to die hard. One day when arriving home to drop off some packages after taking mom to one of her required visits to her doctor's, mom stayed in the house, leaving Dad waiting in the car in our driveway. For the traveling that wasn't required of her, she explained that she would stay home and wait for him to get back. Cut that shit out. We're not starting this again, Angie. Get in the car. Angie agreed to remain in the visible world and never again to withdraw. Now here's a myth that kind of fits me. Recently, an answer to a problem I've been working on for years has risen to the surface of my consciousness. The problem is with courage, or specifically, the inability to stand up or speak for myself. This theme has appeared in my dreams, where I'm crawling on my hands and knees, unable to walk standing up, and in dreams where I'm trying to speak, no voice comes out of my mouth. My hero's journey models the tale in Greek mythology of Theseus and the Minotaur. King Minos asked Poseidon, the god of the sea, to give him a sign of favor in an upcoming battle. Poseidon promised that he would send a bull from the sea. Minos, in turn, agreed to sacrifice the bull directly back to the god. After Minos wins the battle, King Minos thought the bull so beautiful that it was a pity to kill it. He wished to keep it in his herd and breed from such a fabulous beast. So he substituted his second best bull and sacrificed that to the god instead. Like so many of us, he was not content once he got what he wanted. He thought he would go for more. As punishment for this selfishness, Poseidon drives Tig Minos' wife with a mad passion for the bull, and she bears the Minotaur named Asterion, half man and half bull. King Minos, embarrassed by the Minotaur, ordered his chief architect, Daedalus, to build a labyrinth, a chamber of winding halls designed to create confusion, to make sure that no one would ever know the secret of who the Minotaur was and how to get out of the labyrinth. In other words, King Minos wanted to hide his shame. Anyone who entered the labyrinth got lost and eventually killed by the Minotaur. King Minos represents the tyrant within ourselves, a part of us that is unwilling to change. On my journey through the labyrinth, the Minotaur that I imprisoned was fear. While I lived in these walls that I built as a defensive measure against pain, I always worried that the walls might not hold. My dreams reflected this also. I would be in my house checking to make sure all of my windows and doors were shut and locked. I would always find one that was either open or unlocked, and I would have a difficult time shutting or locking it. Maintaining my walls was draining my energy and strengthening the Minotaur. I suspect what I fear won't be half as painful as the anticipated fear that I have. To overcome my fear, I must be vulnerable. To defeat my Minotaur, I must no longer wander among the halls of the Labyrinth. I must face my Minotaur. In the myth of the Minotaur, the hero is Theseus. He's come to slay the Minotaur. Like Percival, Theseus is the part of us that represents a new way of living. King Minos' daughter, Ariadne, falls in love with Theseus the first time she sees him, and asks Daedalus, the architect, how Theseus might find a way out of the labyrinth. He gives Ariadne a ball of thread, and then gives it to Theseus. Theseus is to tie one end to the cave entrance, rolling it out as he travels the labyrinth, and to follow the thread back when he wants out. To walk the labyrinth is to re-enter the womb and travel inward. To come back out is a rebirth. Ariadne's thread is thus an umbilical cord that ties Theseus to the world while he undertakes the hero's journey. When Theseus found the Minotaur, he managed to slay him. By confronting the Minotaur, Theseus makes himself vulnerable. But how do I become vulnerable? The best answer I get is from the Zen philosopher Alan Watts. He said, if you really know how to live from your center, you live now. And know that now is the origin of everything. This way, you stand a much better chance of being able to deal with the unforeseen than if you keep worrying about it and considering past lessons and future possibilities. The past events and future possibilities are my walls. Joseph Campbell once said, and where we had thought to find an abomination, we shall find a God. Where we thought to slay another, we shall slay ourselves. Where we have thought to travel outward, we shall come to the center of our own existence. As I mentioned earlier, the Minotaur's name was Asterion, from which we get the word steer. That makes sense, for the Minotaur was half bull. But in the times of ancient Greece, when this story was told, the word Asterion meant star. I take this to mean that once the Minotaur was dead, Theseus released a star. When we slay the Minotaur in our own lives, whether the Minotaur is fear, shame, or any other negative emotion, what is left is a self before we erect the labyrinth, a star.
Thank you, Butch. That was an awful lot for us to think about and ponder on our own personal hero's journeys in life. We've now come to the point of our service which we set aside for matters of the heart. In a few minutes, we're going to we'll play a musical interlude, and then we will begin a time of sharing of a joy that's lifting you up or a sorrow that's weighing you down. As we've done in the past few weeks, we will have two different options for sharing. So you can share through placing a message in the chat, and Mike McNeil will read the entries that are in our chat at the end of the time of sharing, or you can share verbally using the Zoom raise your hand feature. But first, let's have a musical interlude, and then I will give some additional instructions on using the raise your hand feature. This musical interlude is also a brief portion of the theme from The Last of the Mohicans. This also written by Trevor Jones, as you might imagine, but this is actually performed by Amir Hossein Kianpour. So enjoy that, and then we'll be back for sharing of matters of the heart in a minute or two. This time of sharing to a close, singing, we'll be singing Spirit of Life. The words will appear on your screen. And this is will be sung by Christine Perry and accompanied by Isaac Strader.
And now, as Phil extinguishes our chalice, I will read closing words that actually describe our closing song. In 1979, Harry Belafonte explained the inspiration for this song as he before he performed it. He said, "I discovered that song in Africa. I was in a country called Guinea. I went deep into the interior of the country, and in a little village, I met with a storyteller. That storyteller went way back in African tradition and African mythology and began to tell this story about the fire, the sun, the water, the earth. He pointed out the whole of these things put together turns the world around, that all of us are here for a very, very short time. In that time that we're here, there really isn't any difference in any of us if we take time out to understand each other. The question is, do I know who you are or who I am? Do we care about each other? Because if we do, together we can turn the world around." And so our closing song is Turn the World Around, written by Harry Belafonte and Harry Friedman. And this is a performance by Harry Belafonte. Thank you.
come from the water, living in the water. Go back to the water, turn the world around. We come from the water, living in the water. Go back to the water, turn the world around. We come from the water, living in the water. Go back to the water, turn the world around. Go back to the mountain, turn the world around. We come from the mountain, and we're on the mountain. Go back to the mountain, and turn the world around. We come from the mountain, and we're on the mountain. Go back to the mountain, and turn the world around. Whoa, oh, so is life. Ha, ha, so is life. Whoa, oh, so is life. Ha, ha, so is life. Do you know? So is life. River, river, watch the mountain fire, make the sunlight turn the world around. Heart is of the river, body is the mountain, spirit is the sunlight, turn the world around. We are of the spirit, truly of the spirit, only can the spirit turn the world around. We are of the spirit, truly of the spirit, only can the spirit turn the world around.